Guys, today's episode is brought to you by Ralphie May's very first Netflix original comedy special, Unruly. Nothing is off limits in this special. It was filmed live in front of a raucous, fist-pumping crowd in Atlanta. Ralphie unleashes his hilarious, uncensored perspective on everything. Ralphie May, Unruly, is streaming now only on Netflix. Guys, today's episode is also brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com. Whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design, no matter what you're looking to do, they probably got a course on it. Go to Lynda.com/crack today. That's LYNDA.com/crack for a 10-day free trial. On to the episode. The internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we're talking about people who are so famous they probably don't know what a podcast is. Like, we'll start with Harrison Ford, move on to a bunch of musicians like Garth Brooks and Elvis, Whitney Houston. Musicians who are so famous, they're in that level, small groups of people. Not just because I believe that I can, by definition, get away with talking shit about them because they don't know what a podcast is, but because I'm starting to believe that being super, hyper, the most famous is worse for you than most types of drug addiction and mental illness. We envy famous people, and we envy hyper-famous people the most of all, but that's weird for a thing that, when you take a step back, almost always ends up killing them or driving them completely insane. It almost ends up functioning like a developmental disability, just like in small doses. Just famous people, not necessarily the most famous people, but I've spoken in the past about my suspicion that people who have been, you know, moderately famous for over a decade at this point are at an incredible disadvantage because of how fast technology moves and how easy it is for them to not use it, since they have teams for that. They have people. I guarantee you, Matthew Perry has never typed out a response to an email on a smartphone. He has assistants for that. But obviously, it goes deeper than that. Bill Cosby was the most famous comedian in the world for my entire childhood, and he was famous for being relatable and human. Like, he'd just get up there and sit in a chair and talk, and the words that would come out made so much sense to people that they laughed the most at just the sense of what he was saying. And that's what he was famous for, and it turns out he was actually a monster behind the scenes. And it really is like being the most famous something. There's just some distinction there that ruins you. Being the most famous at comedy or at your type of music. The two most famous rappers from the golden age of rap, when rap goes from nursery rhyming to flows just flowing through Biggie like trees to branches, cliffs to avalanches. That was actually one of his lyrics. I didn't just have a stroke there. He flowed that way across three full albums worth of songs. He had one regular album, one double album, and he was just the best rapper on the face of the earth, according to one side of the country. He dies. Guy who's considered the best rapper on the other side of the country, Tupac. He dies. The most famous member of the Wu-Tang Clan makes himself incoherent with drugs and eventually dies of an overdose. The most famous grunge musician dies. We've had two male artists who were deemed the kings of their respective fields of music, pop for Michael Jackson, and I think Elvis was considered the king of rock. That doesn't seem like it can be right, because I don't even consider what he did rock. But yeah, I think he was the king of rock and roll. Now, that one's weird, because they both went crazy like they were suffering from like a weirdly specific mental illness that makes you build elaborate theme parks that you live in and then hire a team of doctors to give you so much powerful prescription medication that you die in those homes. Yeah, that's really weirdly specific. Around the same age, too. Both homes had land, Graceland and Neverland. Anyways, people have talked about that before. We won't talk about that today, but we are talking about this idea of this weird thing that fame does to people. We talk about Whitney Houston, and I say that I assumed when I saw the album cover, in the 80s, the cover of her first album, that she spoke like Sade, which is a ridiculous thing for me to say because she was way more famous than Sade. My parents just were way into Sade. So that's what came out of my mind when I was 6 years old and saw that album cover. But Whitney Houston was the most famous R&B singer of the 80s and 90s. And, you know, she's the one that died, not Sade. Not saying that I wish Sade had. My wedding song is a Sade song. Anyways, we start out talking about our theory that Harrison Ford is incredibly cartoon character-ishly clumsy. Like if there's a rake on your lawn, he'd step on it and have it come up and smash his nose, and then he'd like run into a door jam and stuff you only see cartoons about blind guys walking around pretending they can see do. Mr. Magoo, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, from there, we somehow end up talking about that question of whether being that type of famous is specifically bad for you. Back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then.
You did a funny music joke today, Jack. That was, give me all your ovens, all your mugs and dishes, too.
Are you getting this, Brett? Please tell me you're getting this.
I told Sirlatov that they could have that for their commercials. I was just sitting there
at my desk.
You just
called them up after you came up with it?
Yeah.
You're like, hey.
Well, I put it out there on Twitter. I thought if they wanted it, they'd come to me.
Well, thank you for that. That's Soren Bowie. Bowie?
At this point, doesn't matter.
Fuck it.
How have we not figured this out yet? Because I still say Bowie in my head, too, and that's not right.
No, it's Bowie.
That's crazy.
I never said Bowie until someone pointed out that they always said it that way and then got in my head.
And that was it.
Like a thought disease. Speaking of thought diseases, we're joined on the phone by Christy Harrison. I don't know what that was supposed to mean. How you doing, Christy?
I'm good.
Christy, I want to talk to you about your column from the past.
Is this a review?
you thought that, yeah, this is your review.
This is the worst possible place.
No, you had this column drop on the internet yesterday afternoon that confirmed a suspicion I had long had about one Mr. Harrison Ford. And before we get into what that theory is and the just tremendous amount of evidence that you're able to compile in support of that theory, just to lay out the ground rules here, we're going to be speculating about famous people, but in order to keep it from being rude or petty, we will be reserving it to famous people who we're pretty sure are so famous they don't know what a podcast is.
Yeah, there's no chance that they will ever hear this.
Harrison Ford being a great example.
And just to clarify, can those people be dead?
Yes.
I just want to know that for myself. Okay. Well, as long as that's in the rules, okay. I need to clarify at some point. I don't know where you want to put this in there, but David Bell did all that research. That was David Bell.
The article is called Four Signs Harrison Ford is a Blind Guy Acting Like He Can See, which is a weird... Which is a weird claim you never make in the article, but that I wanted to say in the title that it was like he's basically Mr. Magoo, but I didn't think anyone would know who that was. So that's what we landed on. But I don't know if the listener is fully aware that Harrison Ford just landed his plane on a golf course close by where Soren and I used to live, actually.
Yeah, right next to us.
He was coming for us. And that was like a weird one-off news story, but it wasn't the first time that it happened, right, apparently?
No, that's his third crash. He had one, I think, in 1999 where he was like doing a training exercise where he was supposed to turn off his helicopter power, but he didn't pull it up in time, so that happened. Then he had another crash in like 2000. So there's a nice long gap here in between his plane crashes. He had another crash in 2000 in Nebraska. And then he just had this one, I guess, last week where the engine malfunctioned again and he was trying to turn around and he got it safely down. And the pictures are very harrowing. He does not look good in the pictures. So I did want to make sure
harrowing
cool Ford before we ran this. Harrowing. Yeah, like he's got blood all over him and I think he broke his pelvis. It wasn't a pretty thing.
It was a handsome thing is what it was.
Yeah, he was flying maybe a pre or during World War One aircraft when he crashed this time. The other times he was flying a helicopter and then some other plane. It was like a 6-passenger plane was the other one. But that means that he's up there in kind of whatever will get off the ground.
Like, yeah.
He will fly anything.
I mean, he's a trained pilot. This is not just him being like, hey, and like just grabbing the keys.
Yeah.
He flies a lot. but he also crashes more than I would guess most pilots.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if with the amount of hours, you know, like proportionally with the amount of hours he puts in, if he's crashing more than other pilots.
Most pilots don't crash at all, I don't think. I think you crash one time, and that's sort of the rule because most people die when they crash.
Yeah.
And this time he's crashed three planes and walked away from each.
What if he's just like a really great pilot? And that's what this means, is that he's so good that when he survives all the inevitable crashes.
So here would be my evidence against that. He's mostly flying in Los Angeles, it seems like, which is like in Santa Monica, rarely a cloud in the sky. When it's windy here, everyone's like, stay inside. It's terrible. he does this for fun. So he's not transporting goods. I would hazard to guess that he has fewer miles logged than a lot of career pilots. And three crashes just seems like a lot. And also, I used to live near that airport. Not a lot of planes falling out of the sky and landing on the golf course next door. That's a fairly rare thing. And Harrison Ford has managed to pull it off with, did you say two planes and one helicopter? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
I think he's a serious pilot. In fact, I think that's the only thing he's serious about. I would venture that's the one thing he's totally committed to is his piloting.
Earrings, piloting, and I've always had the sense that he smokes a lot of pot.
Yeah, he has that sense. Yeah, you watch him when he's in interviews and stuff, and he just couldn't care less about the interview.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that he's kind of in his own head.
And sort of just annoyed by the whole thing. Yeah. Like, grumpy guy who's kind of grumpy about the fact
Why do you say pot? Why do you specifically say pot?
I have no idea.
That too, and I don't know what it is about him.
Old men with earrings are just weed smokers.
Or pirates.
There's like a rule.
Yeah. I don't know why it is. I've always gotten the sense that the most existentially terrifying thing that could possibly happen to any human being would be for Harrison Ford to smoke pot and watch his own movies. Like, I feel like he finds the fact that he's a movie star really weird. But anyways, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that he is a clumsy man, something that I had noticed in basically every one of his action movies. When he throws a punch, it is usually followed by him falling forward 2 to 3 steps and his suit jacket flying up over his head.
That I think is really interesting is how freaking old he was when he got started. So, like, he's in all these action movies, but he didn't start until he was, like, 40. So he wasn't trained to be a stuntman or to know how to fall and to run and to look good on screen. And so it makes sense now, in retrospect, to look back at his work and say, okay, that's kind of an amateur doing a professional's job, especially when he brags, I try to do as many of my stunts. And it shows. If you go back and look.
I don't think actors tend to do a lot of running and training, right? Like, he was a carpenter. I would assume most carpenters are more athletic than most Hollywood stars, just based on how Steven Seagal runs.
Well, I guess, like, my go-to is, like, Tom Cruise or Will Smith, maybe. I don't know why he's coming to my head. Like, there are a lot of people who do look good doing their stunts, and I feel like they maybe train a lot.
Yeah, they're hyper-aware of their bodies. They start out kind of as entertainers first and then become actors, so they know. They have, like, a limited understanding of dance. They have a limited understanding of what their body looks at any given moment. And I think Tom Cruise is hyper aware of anything that he does
and what
he looks like. So before he ever runs when a camera's rolling, he's run in front of a length-long mirror to make sure it looks cool.
Yeah, we talked about this on the last version of this conversation we had, that he clearly knows that he looks good running. But he's also rare in terms of people who run a lot on camera. I could only think of a few examples of Harrison Ford running on camera. You know, Indy kind of running away from the boulder.
Yeah, Fugitive. All he's doing is running.
So yeah, in The Fugitive, that was the first one that came into my head, is like he's running through the woods, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he tore his ACL doing that.
Yeah.
Like, that's so, like, the one of the two times that I can think of him running, he tore his ACL.
That's the thing about him, though, and I think that there's a lot of other actors that are trying to emulate him, even though he maybe stumbled onto it by accident, and stumbled I really genuinely mean there, but he stumbled on this thing of realism that no one else was doing at the time. Everything looks so hyper-stylized, and one of the most endearing things about Harrison Ford is that he's so genuine in everything. When he takes a punch, it looks like he really got hit. So if you ever see people like Nathan Fillion interviewed, they will say, oh no, I base everything I do off of Harrison Ford because he looks so real all of the time. If he's in a fight, it's so sloppy and awkward and terrible that it's really almost painful to watch. That feels very real.
That's interesting because I read a description of the new Star Wars trailer, and one of the things that people liked about it that was missing from the prequels is that it actually felt like everything had weight to it. You know how like CGI, it just, you can tell it's just kind of floating
there's no
gravity, it's been drawn there. But like when the guy like flies the plane in a circle, you like feel like that's a heavy plane that he's having to pull up, or it just feels like everything's actually there. And maybe that's what was missing from the prequels, was just Harrison Ford gives everything weight. Like that, it's just like
you're well aware that this man is affected by gravity. Right. There's no question about whether or not gravity has a hold on him.
Is like there's just a really subtle like, like he's just very uncomfortable.
Yeah, movement just feels like a begrudging thing to him. But
yeah,
like
he doesn't want to be here. He doesn't want to be doing this, and he just kind of stumbled into it. And we like him for that, but that doesn't mean that he's good at it. Like there's something very fascinating about how he ended up where he is. And how much maybe he hates it. Like, I can't tell if he likes his job or if he enjoys who he is. That's why I thought it was interesting that you said pot, because I feel like he'd be nicer. Like, he would be more relaxed and enjoyable to watch on interviews if he was on pot.
Sorry, just real quick, I do want to go through his list of injuries
you guys found,
because I don't think people know these by heart. One anecdote that I already knew was that the awesome part in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where the guy is doing all the swordplay stuff, and then Indy just pulls out the gun and shoots him, that was actually supposed to be an elaborate swordplay whip battle, and Harrison Ford had diarrhea that day and was like, I'd rather not do that. Why don't we just do it this way? So this great cinematic moment was brought to you by Harrison Ford's weak immune system.
And you just see it on his face. You just see he needs to get back to his trailer immediately.
Yeah, it's clearly like discomfort, like uncomfortable sweat.
Right.
It's not just like they sprayed him with that. It's
cold,
like, yeah, that's a well-earned sweat he's got there going in that scene. He also tore his ACL on the set of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the other movie that I can remember him running in.
Temple of Dune, he got spinal injuries.
Yeah, and that one he trained for. I read about this because he actually worked hard on looking good on camera for that one. He trained with the guy who does Body by Jake. Like, he got into fitness for a while, and he's actually kind of ripped in that movie. And I think that's the most effort he's put into training his body for a movie. But I think that one's not as well loved, right? Like, we didn't need that from Harrison Ford for him to do his job, actually. I think the interesting thing is that before he ever even started acting, that he ripped his face up. When he was beginning his career, and I have a picture in the column of, I have one from his high school yearbook and one from his college yearbook. He's such a handsome man. He's still very handsome. But like, he was on his way to work, I think, and he was messing with the seatbelt and he hit a telephone pole, and that's the gash that you see in his chin, and I think his nose too, because his nose is definitely crooked.
Let that be a lesson to car manufacturers everywhere. Take seatbelts out of your cars. They've done nothing. They've caused us nothing but trouble.
Yeah. Apparently his nose has been broken 3 or 4 times.
Right. I couldn't find all the documentation on that, but you can see it is definitely leaning to the left.
Yeah,
the way that you've
described it in the column is his nose looks like it's trying to run away from his face.
When he finally started acting, he was in an episode of Gunsmoke and fell on his gun and knocked his 2 front teeth out, which is like, I can't picture how that happens.
I can't either. That's amazing. And I think he said, there was one interview where I think he said 4 of his top teeth are fake. And I just assume from clumsiness, just from falling and running into things. But I think that's what's charming. Like, if he had kept this really nice face, it's that the combination of the scar and the crooked nose and the fact that he was rejected for 10 years before he got his first big break that made him interesting and set him apart from other actors. Like, when he was cast in American Graffiti, which takes place in the 50s, he said, I'll do it. And he had no movie parts up to this point. I'll do it, but I don't want to cut my hair. So they put a hat on him so that he would not totally blow the whole movie with his longish hair, because he didn't care. He didn't care anymore. He was already over Hollywood.
The dream was dead.
Yeah, but I think that's what people like. They like his messed up face and not caring, and the fact that he wouldn't cut his hair for a 50s movie.
He just like is in constant pain from all his injuries, so he doesn't want to do anything. He's like an old person. He's like, I don't want to get out of bed. And we're just like, ah, oh, he's such a badass.
Yeah, he's so like cool.
He's like, my gums hurt.
You're like, ah, Han Solo, what a badass. Look at that scowl he's got going.
It's just an old dog that can't get in the truck anymore.
Oh, and speaking of that new Star Wars trailer feeling like it had weight, when he got back in the Millennium Falcon, the door from the Millennium Falcon fell on his leg and he broke his leg. Like, it's just like he can't stop hurting himself.
But I mean, he's the coolest guy in the world. I think that people like Bruce Willis have now modeled their careers off of Harrison Ford. I think Bruce Willis, you can see a dramatic change in Bruce Willis. He maybe saw Harrison Ford going and doing his press junkets and stuff like that for movies and just not caring, and everybody loving him more for not caring. And I think Bruce Willis at some point went, well, fuck this. What am I doing? I could just be doing that and people would still love me. And now Bruce Willis is barely civil in any interview he does.
I think that's giving Bruce Willis a lot of credit, because I think it's another case for a different reason that he just doesn't want to be a movie star. He thinks he like has a shitty job. I did this video about like people who are like bizarrely out of touch, famous people who are out of touch with really obvious things. And there's this interview where Bruce Willis is in a bathrobe, because I don't know, and but like with normal clothes underneath, and he's with the lady from Weeds, and they're talking to a guy, and it becomes clear that like he hasn't seen many movies. Bruce Willis doesn't know the names of most movies. Like, they're having a conversation about Miyazaki, and Bruce Willis feels left out, and so he goes, what about Smell a Sense of Snow?
Oh, yeah, I've seen this.
Yeah, and they're like, that's the name of a movie. Good work. But like, he's just like real sour about it. And I ended up cutting the second half of that entry, which was all about how after he started like acting a little bit, he was like, okay, finally, now I've got my chance. I'm going to launch my blues album.
Yeah.
And he released this album. He called himself Bruno. And he, like, played the harmonica and danced around. If you ever see, like, the first thing he ever appeared in was a Siemens wine cooler commercial where he, like, dances around and sings the theme song. That's what he thought his skill was, actually. And that's, like, why he got into this, was to launch his white guy blues career. And I really think that, like, he hates being in movies. And when you watch just footage from around the time of the launch of Bruno, like, he gave himself to this like album and like the idea that he was going to be a famous musician so hard. And like the fact that that didn't succeed, but this stupid movie Die Hard did, just kills him. And he's like furious. And those really do seem like the two people who aren't really actors at all. They're just like guys whose movie careers are based on the fact that they don't want to be there. Like, that's apparently a thing.
I wonder what that says about us, that we actually enjoy watching somebody begrudgingly do this one particular job. Like, we prefer it when they're doing it against their will. It reminds me of some kid in college who's a theater minor. Didn't really want to be part of the theater department, but just happened to be kind of good at it and thought, oh, I could coast through this. And just continually getting sucked back into it and everyone being like, oh, come on, let's do a communal back rub. Let's do this. And him hating every single aspect of the theater department.
Has he done comedy ever?
Sort of.
He did. He hosted SNL, I think, for the first time recently. And was really bad.
I mean, he did Whole Nine Yards, and he's really funny in that.
You guys, he's not coming up with those lines. Those lines are written for him. Everything that you've...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and like, when you watch this interview where he's being interviewed and like barely able to keep up, but like pissed off and like resentful of the guy for even being in his presence, like you really get the sense that he's not a very funny guy. But I do like the idea, like in Die Hard, the role that like made his career, and everyone was like, that's a Bruce Willis, that's how you Bruce Willis, and he's been cast as that thing that we love ever since then. His character had like cut up feet. He was like dragging ass around like Harrison Ford in reality. Harrison Ford playing Han Solo in Star Wars had cut up feet and such. That would be amazing.
Another universe, a parallel universe, where he continued with his comedy career and he kept developing in
Bruce
that
Willis?
Direction. And
Bruce Willis didn't have a comedy career. He wasn't like a stand-up comedian. Like, Michael Keaton was a stand-up comedian who then got into acting, right? But Bruce Willis was just...
Well, but he was a comedic actor, right? Wasn't he?
I think he's still funny in certain things. I think he's got great instincts for how to Bruce Willis it up. He's great at delivering lines. I had always assumed
disparaging.
No, look,
words that other people wrote for him.
I've said before, like, when I was 12, my favorite genre of movies was Bruce Willis movies. Like, I just would watch anything that he was in. Like, Last Boy Scout was my second favorite movie behind Die Hard. It's just interesting that the thing that drove his career forward was him being, like, having a chip on his shoulder, I suspect, about his music career not panning out. But that could just be me. You know what? A good example of his sense of humor. So Hudson Hawk was his big wager, like his big, okay, Bruce, you can make anything you want. You're the biggest movie star in the world. What are you going to do? And he starred in this movie, Hudson Hawk, that was like crazy expensive. He's a cat burglar who walks around singing with Danny Aiello. That's how they time a robbery. They're like, okay, you know the drill. And then they sing a song. And then it's like a bunch of like really bad jokes. It was basically like cartoon physics in the real world, but like all the jokes are really weird and shitty. That seems to be more accurate about what his sense of humor is not like the thing that made him a star, but what you do when you become a star. And I feel like thinking he can sing and really bad jokes are what Bruce Willis is all about in his private life.
Yeah.
Soren, what's your theory?
Well, you talked about Last Boy Scout, and I want to talk about Tony Scott. Tony Scott is a director who sadly is no longer with us, but I suspect that throughout his entire life, Tony Scott never knew how to end a single movie he ever made. Because if you watch all his movies, they end the exact same way. Like True Romance. Do you remember the end of True Romance? It's a shootout, but it's between the police, some gangsters, your protagonist. So there's three different groups that are all there. And then you watch Enemy of the State. It's police, gangsters, Will Smith, and Gene Hackman. There's Crimson Tide is a big shootout between three different groups, but it happens in a submarine. It's a big Mexican standoff inside of a submarine. Domino is exactly the same thing. It's a shootout between cops, gangsters, and protagonists. He has to have the same ending for everyone because he never learned how to actually make an ending to a movie. So each one is just everybody pulls guns on each other, and that's it.
Yeah, it just like worked really well one
right.
time.
Well, because I think he creates these convoluted plots where it's like he's very good at making the protagonist vilified by both this really genuinely evil group and then also the good guys. And he has to somehow prove himself. And so if you just kill everybody else, then the protagonist can walk away clean.
Yeah, that is a good way of getting out of it. Have you ever tried that in real life?
Never.
Oh, we should give that a shot.
I got to buy a gun.
Get yourself in trouble with the mafia and the cops and then be like, meet me here, guys. And then just slowly back out of the room. Because it's the amount of work that you have to do to lay that groundwork is incredible. It's like always the cops hear about the robbers and like it's really strict because he's not writing the movies. So he has to be like, I have a few notes, Quentin Tarantino, about True Romance.
Right. He's telling somebody, listen, I like it all, but the ending, I'd like to see all of them in one room.
Oh, I didn't know he directed Top Gun. Was he gay?
No. Tony Scott?
No?
No.
Oh, weird.
Not that I know of.
Well, because that's one of the...
Because it's such a gay movie?
Yeah, it's super hot. Like, I am not gay, but I am when I watch Top Gun.
Here's what I think happened with Top Gun, is that Tony Scott had essentially said, I want to make a movie that's rock and roll. Rock and roll in the air. And so if you look at rock and roll at the time that Top Gun was made, it was the most feminine, weird... Like,
oh, that's true. It was like during glam rock, yes. Like hair metal.
It was Twisted Sister. It was Motley Crue. Like, these were the bands that were the biggest hits. Great White.
Kenny Loggins. Oh. I guess not. I wonder if Kenny Loggins ever did experiment with that.
To be sexy, you had to look like a woman.
Eyeshadow. Yeah, that was considered super cool. That's really funny, actually, because that is what he said, right? He was like, Top Gun is rock and roll in the air.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino's analysis of that movie is incredible.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, I don't even know what movie it is that he actually says it in, but he's a character in some movie, and he talks about his position on Top Gun, and it's really, really smart.
Yeah, because he won't have sex with her until she dresses up as a man. It's really it's really strange. I wonder if he was knowingly doing that or doing that with a wink and a nudge or just was like, let's make this super homoerotic. I think I've had enough. I might get a little drunk.
If you're the right kind of person, and I mean
a good person, the right type of person, not the wrong kind of person. The Princess Bride is probably one of your favorite movies of all time. And it was also apparently one of the most fun productions of all time. The whole Miracle Max scene was basically made up on the spot by Billy Crystal, and Mandy Patinkin bruised his rib trying not to laugh, and Rob Reiner had to leave the set altogether because he was laughing so hard, apparently. For that story and more, mostly pertaining to Andre the Giant's farts, check out As You Wish by the Dread Pirate Roberts himself, Cary Elwes. And you can even hear him read it on Audible.com. Audible's the audiobook service with over 150,000 titles to choose from. And oh, wow, look at that. They happen to be sponsoring today's episode. Unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books, and they offer free apps for iPhones, Android, and Windows phones, so you can access your books anytime. Go to audiblepodcast.com/crack today and get a free trial and a free book. And if you don't like what you choose, you can exchange any book for another title anytime, no questions asked. So basically, you've got nothing to lose. That's audiblepodcast.com/cracked. You know why James Bond always looks so good, but then when you put on a suit, it just looks baggy around the knees or something weird like that? Well, that's because James Bond takes his James Bond money and goes to the best tailors, and it's not really fair, you know? That suit Daniel Craig wears as James Bond cost him probably $40,000, and that's basically class warfare, which is what James Bond is, if you think about it. But bonobos decided they're not going to stand for it anymore. Their clothes feature a revolutionary and customizable fit, so you can know what you order is going to look cool without even trying it on. But if you're skittish like that, you can even visit them in person and they'll hold your hand and even get you a drink while you try on your clothes. Everything will be okay. Go to bonobos.com, that's bonobos.com, and use promo code CRACKED for 20% off your first order. And get ready to fight the man and look impeccable doing it. That's bonobos.com, promo code CRACKED.
Woke up an optimist. Sun was shining, I'm positive. Then I heard you was talking trash. Hold me back, I'm about to spaz.
All right, can I talk about my Garth Brooks theory?
Please.
We just recorded a video today. We just taped a video today in which we watched and reacted to his announcement that he's on Facebook. And Christy, I wanted to discuss this also with you because you seem to think that this was like a thing he was doing as a joke, right? Like, you're a little bit more familiar with his career. Like, I know Friends in Low Places and The Thunder Rolls. I didn't realize he is the highest selling artist of all times. Like, he sold more records than the Beatles. And
his album is the Bible, that. Basically.
I wouldn't say I am super familiar with his career. Like, you guys know all the songs from, what's the album that came out in the 90s?
Black and White?
The one that has
Rope in the Wind?
The other one, Rope in the Wind. So if you don't know, everybody knows all those songs, right?
I only know Friends in Low Places and The Thunder Rolls.
Okay. There was this moment when I went to college in 1994, and there was this moment where, you know, none of us listened to country music. We were cool. We were listening to alternative music.
Whatever. Oh, yeah.
And if one of the not cool people played Rope in the Wind, everybody just knew every song. It was this weird phenomenon that I don't know if it was a Texas thing or just one after the other. You just kind of absorbed them in your childhood when I was growing up. So that's just as far as I know about him and his music. But I do know that he was on Saturday Night Live one time, I think in the 90s. I'm not sure when the...
It was 99. I can mark it in 90. I'll explain why later, but keep going.
And I remember him, I just remember him seeming very self-aware. He was very naturally funny and totally a good performer. So, and I know that he was very famous for his concert performances, that he was very energetic and charismatic and just a likable person. So I think that what you were seeing on the Facebook post, and I haven't revisited it again, was his version of trying to kind of recapture that funny connecting with his audience. I think he thought he was being funny.
Can we play it
let's
run it back. So this is anyone who hasn't seen it should go watch it a few dozen times and
like you did. Okay.
The basic setup is it's Garth. He's shooting it with his laptop camera, and he's sitting there. You just see his face filling up the screen. You're kind of sitting on his lap slash stomach area, I would guess. And while we're bringing up Garth Brooks' Facebook video, so I remember the SNL sketch pretty well because it had that devil sketch from the best of Will Ferrell. And I think I was watching the episode when it came on. And I agree, he was like solid for a musician. He did a pretty decent job. But he introduced the musical guest as Chris Gaines. It was his alter ego. So this might not be a thing most people remember. But so he toured through the 90s. He released his first album in 89. From 89 to 99, he became the highest selling artist ever, outsold the Beatles, like I said. And then in 99, he was like, and now I'm going to create this huge multimedia project where I pretend to be a rock musician named Chris Gaines. And if you don't remember this, Chris Gaines essentially looks like Chris Angel. He's like got goth hair, flat ironed hair, and like a soul patch. And Garth Brooks was going to release an album as Chris Gaines. And there was supposed to be a movie about the creation, the life and times of Chris Gaines. And he went all in on this. So that's your first clue that he at least, because his whole thing is like, I'm an energetic but like down home guy. I look like your dad's friend. I wear ugly shirts. All of his albums have him wearing just a real ugly shirt on it. And so it seems kind of weird that he would have such a big ego that he would create an alter ego, right? Like Prince creates an alter ego, or Bono has created three alter egos.
Clinton Portis.
That's the sort of thing.
Is that an ego thing, though? I don't equate it to an ego thing. I equate it to trying something new.
No, I think it's an ego thing.
I don't know. I don't.
Beyonce's done it.
Definitely.
Beyonce did it.
Sasha Fierce. Like, it's a way of...
No, and I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. It's just not a country thing. It's not a Garth Brooks thing. It's a very theatrical thing, I guess. Coming out saying, hey, I'm Garth Brooks, and I'm just your everyday, like, cowboy. And our musical guest tonight is Chris Gaines. Who is this mysterious guy? It's like that... It just, like, doesn't fit. And he released the album as Chris Gaines, and that was it for him for a while. I think this Facebook video is part of him coming out and doing a world tour. So he's like, this is his comeback tour. And my people, the Irish, were supposed to have a concert in Dublin that was like his first concert in a long time. And then he had to cancel it because the stadium wasn't going to be ready or wasn't to his liking. And it devastated all of Dublin. Like, it's become a huge political issue in Dublin because...
IRA's back because Garth Brooks...
yeah, exactly. It's a...
I hadn't heard this. Wow.
No, it's not like... That's, it's just like having a mini Olympics come to your city, having Garth Brooks come back and, like, tour. Okay, so totally this is Garth Brooks being like, hey, guys, I'm back, and it's just me, regular old Garth.
Well, I guess it's official. Okay. We're now on Facebook. I really wasn't sure about this at the start. But then a friend of mine said something that just made all kinds of sense. She said, think of it more as a conversation. I like that. But I'm already finding out on my own. So it's wiping the walls out between you and me. And I really like that. It allows us into each other's worlds, or I guess in my case, a hotel room. When I think about things I want to post cool stuff, slick stuff, neat stuff. But most of the stuff I'm going to post is going to be raw stuff like this. This is just who I am. So if this is truly a conversation, then I say let the conversation begin.
So now just a few things for people, because that was an obviously rehearsed speech that you heard.
What?
He isn't reading off of note cards. He's staring directly into the camera. So he had memorized that speech that he had clearly written. He has sort of a half smile, like sort of a wistful, like, my friend told me about that, like, for most of it. But the only time he, like, really cracks an open smile is when he says, into each other's worlds, or in my case, hotel room. And that's his laugh line. I don't think that he is self-aware enough to have created that brilliant of a video, because it really is, like, one of the strangest things I've ever seen
and
or heard.
If he did create that as something that's supposed to be funny, Not only did we not get it, his audience didn't get it either. Because if you go on his Facebook page and look at all of the comments and stuff, there's nobody playing along with that. It's all earnest comments about, I'm so glad you're here.
We miss you, Garth. Garth is the nicest guy. Garth gives to charity, which he apparently is really nice. There's like a lawsuit that alleges that he was trying to become an actor in the 90s, but turned down the role that Barry Pepper played in Saving Private Ryan of the sniper because he didn't think he should have to share top billing with Tom Hanks. And that's alleged. But TMZ printed it.
Allegedly.
And they have a bunch of really good lawyers. So I'm going to assume that there's some basis for it. But anyways, when you think about people who get that famous and have that much success, they're usually dead by now, or you don't see them very much. Like Eddie Murphy mm-hmm. is sort of mm-hmm. that way.
Either they die or their persona dies.
Like Paul McCartney's like kind of kept it together, but he seems weird. Like yeah. this guy who's like famous for being sort of a great songwriter and like looking like your dad. It's either he's crazy or Garth Brooks is a character that he's playing. And just like Chris Gaines was, Garth Brooks is a character that he's playing, and he's a terrible fucking actor, is what that video would lead me to believe.
That's so creepy and weird, but I still think it's like your dad trying to be funny and just doesn't have enough people saying, that's not funny.
I think that...
You know, this
is somebody who...
But he's making love to the camera with his eyes the entire time. Am I wrong,
sir? No, not at all. I think what happened is, this is somebody who's not familiar with Facebook at all. He just knows that millions of people
right.
will see this.
Absolutely, that's
and
true.
And he's getting on
and
it.
And he knows they'll love him no matter what.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think that he's getting on there and he's thinking to himself, everybody just does these videos. Well, I need mine to be good. I need it to be Garth good. And he's trying to make it as good as possible and something that's polished, but he doesn't want you to see his feet paddling underwater. Like, he doesn't want you to know how much effort it takes to swim. And instead we get this where it's like, whoa, what am I actually looking at?
Right. Yeah, it's clearly rehearsed and like so much energy going into it to act like no energy is going into it. I was saying in the video today right. that like I'm almost positive that three assistants got fired trying to write that before he was like, I'll just do it myself. only Garth can write Garth. There's another weird video where he and his wife go up on stage in Oklahoma where they're from, and they both seem like out of sorts, like maybe they had just had a fight or something, but like he's like answering things in these like weird little sound bites that don't really make sense, like they don't logically cohere. And then whenever his wife talks, he just like slightly tilts the microphone towards her, and then at one point he just takes the microphone over to the side of the stage and puts it away, and like there's like this loud feedback, but he just walks back to the center of the stage and starts answering questions without the microphone, and you can't hear
what?
It. I just wonder if he's like totally lost his mind.
Gosh, I just don't know enough about Garth Brooks to
I know I've
where
just
he is in his head right now.
I haven't been able to stop researching Garth I haven't been able to stop researching Garth Brooks since I saw that video.
Oh good.
Which, by the way, people should yeah. know that when he says, or in my case, hotel room, he does tilt the camera around to show you that he is in fact in a hotel room,
because he's an everyman.
So
look, he's
it
a
is a funny
man on
joke. I mean, it's a funny joke.
It's funny also because he says, I want to post cool stuff, slick stuff, but I also am going to post some raw stuff like this. You go and you look at his Facebook page. It's got two or three other videos that are just his concerts, like that somebody else has shot. He's never done this again.
And right.
He made this.
Well, he's still working on his follow-up to that video. He's like been rehearsing the performance for...
He hired some big writers on this one, and yeah. he's going to get some good lighting.
So I had always thought Garth Brooks, he probably just aged out of the country industry and now is like somewhere writing songs or something and like being like my dad, you know, just a dad looking guy, except he wears cowboy hats. But this made me suspect when I saw this video that it's like closer to like Axl Rose. He's like just been like going crazy in like in some mansion somewhere.
I wonder if he still puts on good shows. Like that's what I think it's all about. If this guy never quite kept his grip on reality and doesn't know how to talk to people in real life, that's to be expected when you're on that level of celebrity. But if you're still putting on good shows and you can still perform and run around on a stage and sing well, and then it's all forgiven because you kept doing the thing that you're really good at.
That's true.
Which we can't say for Axl Rose. Axl Rose, he went crazy and he dropped the ball with
his
voice.
That- That was an accurate indicator of the mental health of Michael Jackson as well. As long as he could still perform, we knew everything was cool with him, right?
And he could. I think he could, right? Like, yeah.
You were making fun of me. I'm making fun of you, Christy. Michael Jackson was still a great performer well after he had just completely lost his fucking mind.
So that's what the other thing is. Is it our job to assess the mental health of our celebrities or to just say good job at doing your job? Like, because nobody's going to look at you and I and do a podcast on how crazy we've gotten.
No, yeah. Work. Absolutely not.
And
I'm fascinated by what fame does to people because I think being famous is like a type of mental illness, but I think people like kind of give them the benefit of the doubt. And a lot of times that's like not deserved and like almost the opposite. Like I would be nervous that if I was hanging out with any famous person that like there was something creepy about them just because famous people get to do whatever they want. It's almost like an interesting study in like how shitty humans are if they're just given free rein to get away with whatever they
yes,
want.
Yes, it's heart of darkness inside all of us, right? So it's I don't think it's just that these celebrities happen to something changes in them. I think that every single day you're expressing thoughts or you're having thoughts that are leaning towards insanity, that are bad ideas, that aren't good, aren't well thought out. But if you don't have somebody who's constantly curbing that in your life or a self-esteem that's curbing it for you, that you only have people surrounding you who are telling you how great it is and encouraging every single idea that you have, then eventually you start believing it yourself and that each one of them are good. And it just, there's this one part of us that's just now has free reign and can do whatever it wants. And you naturally will go insane.
Yeah.
That is grim. That is a very grim view of humanity.
Well, I don't think... I think
I
it's
think
only a grim view of what fame is and like the type of society we've built around it. Like I've been saying since at least the late 90s that absolute power corrupts absolutely. I made that up, I think.
That's really
and
good. Jim.
Yeah, that's good,
you should
right?
write that in a book.
But when psychiatrists or people who study brains are interested in the guy who like got a railroad spike through his eye that came out the other side and survived, they study what happened to his personality because that's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to a human brain physically, and someone was able to survive and continue to talk and be like, this is what it looks like in here. And I think Michael Jackson probably led objectively the strangest life in the history of the human race, or at least like Western culture. And it's interesting to pay attention to like what he did and what he said and like try and figure out what it's like to be Garth Brooks.
Yeah,
like
track his trajectory
based on that Facebook video. Like that just seemed so strange to me. Like a
but it's not Michael Jackson strange, but it's not dyeing your skin and wearing a wig and that strange. It's just a guy looking at a camera and giving a weird speech versus a lifetime, decades of eccentricity.
But I think you start
you know what I mean? Like,
yes, I do. In fame, you start to think that you are this character. Everybody sees you as something that you're not. Like, that's the biggest complaint among celebrities is that, well, now everybody thinks I'm this. Bruce Willis, for instance, everybody thinks I'm this guy from Die Hard. And when you start to see that everybody wants that one very specific thing from you, you start to be that. And so now you're being a caricature of yourself. And that's exactly where Garth Brooks is, I think. I talked to one of my favorite writers at one point at South by Southwest, actually. It was a writer named Neil Pollack. And he used to write like really great satire, but he'd always write from the perspective of this one character who was just is sort of like Ignatius from Confederacy of Dunces. Like somebody who's just
if he was rich.
Right.
And like went to an Ivy. It's like a combination of Ignatius Riley mixed with Stephen Colbert kind of or like John Hodgman. like John Hodgman's persona crossed with Ignatius.
Yeah, so it's somebody who's just overeducated but also just oblivious to everything that's happening in the world around them. And he's so good at it. And then he just stopped writing in it. He started just writing about his kid or he started writing about yoga. And so when I met him, I talked to him about it. I was like, well, what happened? He said, well, after a while, it became a real problem for me. I started to not be able to separate myself from the character. People around me stopped liking me. Right. And so finally, he just had to kill himself, essentially. He had to kill off this version of himself. And I think that there's a lot of celebrities out there. It's just it inevitably happens that you become the symbol itself. And then you don't know how to extricate yourself from that anymore.
That's why Dave Chappelle going crazy might have actually just been the smartest thing anyone's ever done immediately after becoming super famous. I don't necessarily know what specifically people think about it was crazy other than walking away from a lot of money. But he just like disappeared and decided to kind of put things back on his own terms. Stop. But going back to Garth Brooks, because our listeners, I'm sure, are like, get back to the Garth talk. I do think that...
Don't all roads lead back to Garth Brooks?
Like, Michael Jackson, everything about him was, like, openly, outwardly crazy. I really like Soren's metaphor for the Garth Brooks thing, that it's like a duck gliding on water, and then you look under the surface, and, like, it's just, like, shit's crazy down there. The feet are, like, going nuts. It's like that with craziness, that Garth Brooks video. It's like... calm exterior, and then inside you're just like, holy shit, this guy is a fucking diva. Like,
you know, swing a door open on the Garth Brooks house and it's just pandemonium in there, and then it shuts immediately.
Yeah, exactly. While he's just sitting out front, like, calmly waving, and then, yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's one bad video. I'm still not seeing it.
Well, but it's...
I just think it's one bad video.
It's the Chris Gaines thing. After the Chris Gaines thing, he was like, all right, I'm gonna disappear for a while. And then, like, he comes out, and he's
your dad.
We've lost him. No, he's not my dad anymore, Christy.
Never again.
Also, like, he disappeared, like, around 2000, and 9/11 happened in, what, 2001?
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Just blame Garth Brooks for, for 9/11.
Too far. So I have some theories that are not as distasteful, but...
Oh, weird.
Yeah, and I think this has actually become more of a conversation about, like, how celebrity drives you crazy more than, like, weird celebrity conspiracy theories.
Yeah. It's not a this one's not a conspiracy theory. This is just me becoming obsessed with Whitney Houston recently. And so we all know Bobby Christina, Whitney's daughter, is in a coma. And before that had happened, I had... stumbled upon Being Bobby Brown on YouTube, and I had watched a little bit of it, and I was just enraptured by Whitney Houston's actual personality, which is absolutely nothing like how she was presented her whole life. She was just really crass and really funny, but very rough. And I know because she was on drugs, that's part of the reason why, but it was just nothing like... Like, if you look up her debut album cover, that's like the perfect picture of how she was groomed and presented to the world for most of her life.
Yeah, it's just I thought she talked like Sade mixed with
Soren. Like Sade.
Like, she talked like a white woman based on that cover. You were like, you expected her to be like, oh, hello, my name is... Like, I would have expected her to have a British accent based on that cover. And she's hilarious on Being Bobby Brown. And
I think people... hated her on it. So on that cover, she's 21 years old. She had been groomed by, what's his name, Clive? The guy from... Yeah.
Barker, I think.
He picked her out, and, you know, she had this beautiful voice. She was already a model, like already on 17, and she was already an actress, and they figured they could just kind of mold her into a pop star that would resonate really well with white audiences, and they were absolutely correct. But they wouldn't let her do interviews very often. Like, you can't find very many interviews of her when she's in her early 20s because her voice, her speaking voice, didn't match the persona and the things she said. She just wasn't that person. So I think she was heavily groomed and managed, and by the time she was in her mid-20s, she got the sense that the black community all resented her, and so she just actively sought out a way to rebel. And I think she was already the kind of person who did drugs before she met Bobby Brown. It was just very well maintained and not talked about, and then she like sought him out because that she thought he would give her credibility in the black community. And I think that if they had figured out a way to incorporate her real personality with her music, she wouldn't have been pushed in the direction that she ended up. And then during those years when she was doing drugs, which I think never stopped, I think she kept doing drugs all along, she just didn't take care of her voice. She couldn't perform. She couldn't deliver the product that I suspect Garth Brooks is really good at still delivering on stage.
The number one sign of mental health, being a good performer.
Yeah, she just didn't maintain her product. And so I think towards the end of her life, you know, after she had already divorced Bobby Brown and she had gone to rehab and she had reunited with her original management and she was carefully trying to reconstruct that picture of herself that everybody had before, by that point it was too late because she had already, her health had already deteriorated to the point where she couldn't.
Yeah. And also, deliver. Like, what a horrible thing to have to do, to, like, pretend not to be yourself. And
yeah.
How? What a crazy thing to ask someone to do after they've publicly been like, no, this is what I'm like, this is how I talk. And then you're like, okay, we're going to change that.
I think part of that is she really was on drugs. That really was how she looked. That was, you know, the toll that it took on her body. And then when she tried to correct that, you just can't. You can't undo what you've already done to yourself. But she tried to clean up. And you would see in interviews towards the end of her life, she was trying to hit that mark again, but she couldn't sing because she never quit smoking, and she had heart problems, and she was still doing drugs. And so what I think about her is if she had let it go and let somebody manage her all along, she would still be here, right? Because they would have kept her from making all these mistakes that ended her life. But it would have been better if they had like figured out how to use her real personality. And yeah. I don't know. The psychological toll that it must have taken for her to paint that picture. And it worked. Like, until Being Bobby Brown came out, I don't think anybody knew
right.
who she was. Like, because she was in that Kevin Costner movie. She was in The Preacher's Wife. She played that part really well.
I've never seen either of those. How does she... Does she talk like herself?
No. In The Bodyguard, she would be interchangeable with Barbara Streisand.
Barbara Streisand? Mm-hmm. No way.
Yeah.
So, two quick things on Whitney Houston. Just once again, bragging about my genetic line of oracles that I come from. My parents went and saw her in 1986, I think, like right after that album came out, when that was like in heavy rotation on our boombox. And they were like, man, she was horrible. I think she was on like a lot of drugs. I think everything you said is right, except I think that there's no way that you can tell somebody, okay, go become one of the most famous people in the world, but don't behave anything like you actually are without fucking them up tremendously. The only other time my parents have ever accused a performer of being on drugs, Bobby Brown's performance at the Video Music Awards of the Ghostbusters 2 theme song. They're like, he's really sweating a lot. And then, like, that's a famous performance because you actually see him drop a cocaine vial and, like, pick it up, like, during the performance, which I don't think is what my parents were referring to. They were like, he's just all over the place. And I was like, what is wrong with you guys? That guy's great. He's just, like, he's just an energetic performer. And they were right. The two people who my parents have been able to tell were on drugs ever found each other and fell in love.
In a lot of ways, Whitney Houston is the exact opposite of Harrison Ford, where Harrison Ford was, we only love him for being himself. And Whitney Houston is somebody who were like, oh, no, you have this one very specific talent, but we have to turn you into an entirely different person to show anyone what
exactly.
you can do.
I think after she died, people talked about her being on drugs most of her adult life, but I don't remember hearing that she was not good at live performances ever. And that, like you saying that, is the first I've ever heard of her not being able to perform live. That's interesting to me, that she was already messed up from the beginning, the very beginning. Cause that's way early in her career. That's interesting. So my other thing, Elvis. We think of Elvis in the 70s. Our first thought is the white jumpsuit, and we think, oh, he was such a joke then. But my theory is that was the very best version of Elvis, because that's when he was doing all these concerts. His touring schedule was insane, and you can see footage. You can see footage of him totally high and mumbling and not doing great, but you can see way more footage of him just like knocking the socks off of his old lady audience and doing these really strong, energetic, exciting performances. And he always took care of his voice. Like, this whole time that he was totally high on drugs, he was still able to deliver this product that he was really good at. So I think that there's this parallel between Elvis and, I think people tend to talk about Elvis and the Beatles. And we looked at the trajectory of the Beatles, and they did more exciting stuff later in their careers. They got more experimental. They did weird stuff in the studio. They did all these interesting songs that were innovative. And Elvis just kind of stagnated. But that doesn't recognize what he was actually really good at, which was just performing and just singing. And he stayed on top of his game at performing and singing the whole time. And nobody ever talks about it because he got irrelevant. He wasn't as exciting, and he wasn't, like, he only had 2 years where he was totally relevant in pop culture, and then he was immediately stagnant because he wasn't interested in different kinds of songs, and he wasn't interested in keeping up with the culture of the time. But he was really interested in performing and staying in touch with the fans that liked him. And he kind of set this precedent for other performers today, like Britney Spears, I think, has a Las Vegas show. And lots of people, when they don't want to keep churning out new kinds of music, they realize, okay, this is the time to stay put and keep performing for my core audience and stay relevant in that way, but not necessarily innovate. He was never going to be the Beatles. He was never going to be a good songwriter or someone who did cool things in the studio. So he didn't need that kind of manager. He needed someone to just let him do what he wanted to do at his own pace. And so, yeah, he got fat.
I mean, he used to fly people who worked for him to get him this type of sandwich that he liked from a different state. And it sounds delicious. It was a peanut butter and banana sandwich that was deep fried. But anyways, so I didn't realize, and this is the second time I've heard in 2 days, that Elvis was seen as like a joke after his initial fame. Because I think he's such an iconic figure and has so many fans that I just have this idea of Elvis, and he's an icon, and there's thin Elvis and there's fat Elvis. And I can totally see what you're saying. Like his later years when he's bigger and has the big mutton chops. 70 for me is peak Elvis. And I'm going to explain why.
Really?
Because he has, okay. Well, I don't even care about his music, but just like in terms of like what's awesome about him and like what's unique about him, he's not really big and like sweaty and unhealthy looking quite yet. He just looks like a little bit more filled out, and he has really long hair and really huge fat mutton chops on the side of his head. So a thing people don't realize about him usually is that he never took an illegal drug in his life. It was all prescription drugs from enabling doctors, like just like Michael Jackson. There's a lot of parallels there, actually. But I think you're right that his main thing, he had an incredible voice and was a really good performer, really good at stealing moves from other people, but, you know, did them well and put them together. But certainly, like, he was at his most unique when he was wearing, like, the full-body white rhinestone.
Yeah.
Kind of, and this is just a great glimpse of like a version of the mental illness of fame. In 1970, Elvis became convinced that like he needed to be the undercover drug czar of America and went to the White House. He was wearing a cape at the time for some reason, and like insisted that Richard Nixon see him and was like, look, I know the Beatles are doing illegal drugs. I know Bob Dylan is doing illegal drugs. I hang out with these people. I can like go undercover and like bust all of them. And there's this great picture of him standing next to Richard, like they're shaking hands in the Oval Office. He's wearing a cape. And at that meeting, he gave Richard Nixon a handgun. So like,
yeah,
there's that Jack Handy.
In exchange for a badge.
Yeah, there's that great Jack Handy thing. Like, I think a good gift for the president is a chocolate handgun. And since he's really busy, you'd have to run up and hand it to him. but like Elvis actually did that. Like, that's how famous he was. It's just interesting. That's another example of someone who went spectacularly crazy because he was the most famous person in the world. And another interesting thing about his drug use is that some people think that he didn't really die of a drug overdose. He just took some dental appointment drug that he happened to be allergic to, that he didn't realize it, that he was allergic to.
And there's a theory that he poisoned himself too, that he like just took, it wasn't so much an overdose as he just poisoned himself from the inside out with all the drugs that he took. And I didn't know this, but after the autopsy, someone did a press conference, and whoever did the press conference at the hospital immediately said it was a heart thing and didn't talk about drugs at all, which was a complete lie. And
right.
It didn't come out till later that this was a drug thing, not a heart thing.
Well, it's because he's not really dead. They faked his death. Sorry, but just I do want to get back before I forget. The thing that you said that I think might surprise people is that like he was what Britney Spears is now, like halfway through his career. I was just listening to the episode of WTF with Marc Maron where he was interviewing the co-creator of The Simpsons who just died. And he was Elvis's neighbor growing up. He like lived in Beverly Hills, and Priscilla Presley had a house adjacent to them. And he was saying that as a kid, yeah, he was like thought of Elvis as like a ridiculous hillbilly and was like,
ostentatious.
Yeah.
He
was like, by the time I was, you know, a kid, Elvis was a joke and like nobody thought he was cool. And like one time he returned my dog that ran away and I didn't think that was cool at all. I just thought he was like, you know,
oh my gosh.
You kind of felt sorry for him. I thought Elvis was just always like the most famous person in the world.
No, in Beverly Hills, no. He's the Boo Radley.
Right. Like,
yeah, which is a shame because I think we need to re-examine his 70s legacy. And I swear I spent the whole day watching concert footage. Even when he's so huge. And by the way, not that huge. I mean, like, he's big in some of them, but most of the concerts, he's not that big. Even when he's, like, sweating, even when he's, like, clearly out of it, he's still putting on a show that I don't think anybody else in the world could do right now. Like, it's an amazing performance, no matter how out of it he is, which is what he was good at.
Right. Like, he never just went out there and laid down on the stage like Jim Morrison did.
No.
Like, he was never just like, you listen to me sing like this.
Well, maybe. I don't know. There's probably footage like that out there. But it's also he's also very charming and very fun to watch. I think that's the Garth Brooks thing, too, other than that one crazy video. There is something that's likable about him, so you can connect with them beyond whatever their talent is and whatever their gift is. That I'm going to like, you know, Garth Brooks probably no matter what because he looks like your dad, and I'm going to like Elvis because he seems like a nice guy on stage. Harrison Ford I think I like anyway because he's an old man who's grumpy. And who doesn't like an old grumpy man? Not crazy.
I wonder if, like, being pissed off about your career and just, like, so ungrateful about the fame you have is, like, the most mentally healthy thing that could possibly happen to you because otherwise you just lose it.
Yeah.
Like, you lose your mind.
Yeah, you start to think that you deserve it.
Maybe.
And then that's when you start to really fall apart is that your mind starts to unravel a little bit. But when you feel like you never achieved what you wanted to, the fact that Bruce Willis isn't playing harmonica on the road right now is like the biggest regret of his life, and it's made him probably a more sane person.
Yeah, you know what? When I'm saying that I think fame is like the worst thing that can happen to someone's personality, this is obviously like in light of some of the things we've learned recently, like about like Bill Cosby, and I've recently heard something about a great comedian out here being just like a total creepy pervert. It just seems like once you become the most famous person in a certain community, it's just like a switch flips and like you're just a fucking the worst.
I think it's just a slope that you continually slide down.
Yeah.
You don't realize it's happening. It's like it getting dark outside. Like you don't see it happening as it's happening. But if you were to go inside and then come back out, you'd be like, oh, Jesus.
What am I doing?
People not saying no to you for so long.
Yeah. And again, the fact that the one guy who's like, oh my God, I'm sliding into becoming really famous. I've got to get out of this and just like quit my career for a little while. We're like, man, that guy's crazy as fuck. Dave Chappelle.
What a freak.
Miscellaneous minds, never explaining the minds. Devilish grin for my alias. All right, that was our episode in which we managed to come up with the loose theory for, I think, the very specific strata of fame and success occupied by Garth Brooks and Michael Jackson and Elvis and Whitney Houston. And I think we tied it into the works of Tony Scott, or at least one of the works. He said that he wanted to make a movie that was rock and roll in the air, and he made it about, you know, dudes wanting to have sex with each other because, without exception, the rich white men who ran the music industry in the 80s and the people who bought music in that decade, apparently, made everyone believe that they had to be more like a white woman to succeed. Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson, the glam rockers who Tony Scott was trying to capture in Top Gun. Say what you want about millennials, or whatever we're supposed to call the teenagers who download music without buying it these days. Yep, they're entitled little narcissists. They don't pay for anything, but at least they don't ask their favorite artists to look more like the bland conservative vision of beauty most likely to give their congressman a boner. The 80s was just all fucked up sexually, man. It was a weird decade. Everyone was very ashamed of their looks and into weird stuff anyways. Speaking of great artists, we're not trying to turn into white ladies. Let's get into the footnotes. We heard Hirachi Lights by The Hot Chip. We've heard from them in the past. No Fit State, also a great song off of their Warning album, I believe. This is a new one. I don't know how old they are or if anyone's ever tried to pressure them into being miserable or looking like something they're not. They're a British electronic group who I believe has a new album coming out. Go check it out. Buy it. if you like that song. Stop being so terrible. Everyone buy a song or two or three or 4 or 5 seconds is the next song. Pow! Killer transition. Weird. Grouping of musicians who are all, I guess, survivors based on this conversation. Kanye is his own weird combination of Dr. Dre and Madonna and the Beatles, so no real comparison point there, but Rihanna has survived abusive relationships with her Bobby Brown and, you know, attempts by the music industry and media to sand down her rough edges, and she's still just like, nope, I'm gonna smoke a blunt on Instagram, and now I'm fucking Leonardo DiCaprio, and I don't know, she's got some of the greatest hooks in the history of hip-hop. Man, that Man Down song. There's like a remix of that Man Down song out there. That's one of my favorite things I've ever heard on the radio and not been able to track down on the internet. And I love her vocals on this song, and it apparently has Paul McCartney on there. Also technically a survivor, last surviving member of the Beatles besides Ringo Starr, who's gonna outlive us all. And he only looks moderately like a white lady. He's an honorary member of our article, The Top 25 Men Who Look Like Old Lesbians. But they're all survivors, and as confusing as it is that Kanye West is constantly just on the verge of flipping out about perceived slights and injustices, it's better that than just dying or becoming despondent and, you know, building some weird castle and never making good music again. And this week, we're going to ride out on Kendrick Lamar's verse on Control, in which he refers to himself as Machiavelli, which was Tupac's last album, I think posthumous, and The King of New York, which was what Biggie was referred to. Those two great rappers I referred to in the intro, he's kind of saying they're unified in him, says that he thinks Molly is turning his fellow rappers into a bunch of Lindsay Lohans, but he calls them on it. I'm sure would have made it easier for Michael Jackson to stop turning himself into a white lady if whoever his contemporaries were like, dude, what do you look like? The Wayans brothers, white chicks dressed up like Belinda Carlisle. It's very unnerving. You look very unhealthy. Eat a sandwich. But it is interesting that he specifically calls them on that. I wonder if there's still some slimy record executive out there left over from the 80s putting Molly in Drake's drink and asking him to put on a blonde wig. Sorry to put that image in your head. Speaking of Drake, this verse is famous for calling out every other relevant rapper by name and Kendrick telling them he's trying to murder them, figuratively. We'll probably be hearing more Kendrick off his new album. He's got a new one coming up. He just dropped a new track in the last 24 hours that I haven't had time to digest, but we'll probably be on a future episode. Speaking of that, we're dark next week, but we'll be back the week after with more podcast. Talk to you guys then. Kale flex to drop a bomb on this shit. So many bombs ring the alarm like Vietnam on this shit. So many bombs make Farrakhan think that's a dime in this bitch. One at a time, I line them up and bomb on their mom when she watching the kids. I'm in a destruction mode if the gold exists. I'm important like the Pope. I'm a Muslim on poke. I'm Machiavelli's offspring. I'm the king of New York. King of the coast. One hand, I juggle them both. The juggernauts all in your juggler. You take me for jokes. Live in the basement. Church pews and funeral faces. Cartier bracelets. For my women friends, I'm in Vegas. Who the fuck y'all thought it's supposed to be? If Phil Jackson came back, still no coaching Mick. I'm uncoachable. I'm unsociable. Fuck y'all clubs. Fuck y'all pictures. Show Instagram. Can gobble these nuts. Gobble a dick up to your hiccup. My big homie corrupt. This the same flow that put the rap game on the crutch. West. I seen niggas transform like villain Decepticons. Molly's probably turn these niggas to fucking Lindsay Lohan. A bunch of rich ass white girls looking for parties, playing with Barbies. Wreck the Porsche before you give them the car key. Judgment to the monarchy. Blessings to Paul McCartney. You call me a black beetle. I'm either that or a Marley. Smoke crack, motherfucker, I sell it. I'm dressed in all black, this is not for the fan of Elvis. I'm aiming straight for your pelvis. You can't stomach me, you plan on stumping me. Bitch, I've been jumping for you, put a gun on me. Bitch, I put one on yours, I'm Sean Connery. James Bond and with none of you niggas climbing 100 mil in front of me. And I'm gon' get it even if you're in the way. And if you're in it, better run for peace sake. I heard the barbershops being great debates all the time about who's the best MC, Kendrick, Jigga, and Nas. Eminem, Andre 3000, the rest of y'all. New niggas, just new niggas, don't get involved. And I ain't rocking no more designer shit. White tees and Nike Cortez, this red Corvette synonymous. I'm usually homeboys with the same niggas I'm rhyming with. But this is hip-hop and them niggas should know what time it is. And that goes for Jermaine Cole, Big Crit, Wale.
Pusha T, Meek Mills, A$AP Rocky, Drake, Big Sean, J Electron, Tyler McMillan. I got love for you all, but I'm trying to murder you niggas. Trying to make sure your core fans never heard of you niggas. They don't want to hear not one more noun or verb from you niggas. What is competition? I'm trying to raise the bar high. Who's trying to jump and get it? You're a better off trying to skydive out the exit window with 5G5s with 5 grand with your granddad as the pilot. He drunk as fuck trying to land with a handful of arthritis and popping prosthetic leg, bumping pock in the cockpit. So the shit that pops in his head is an option of violence. Someone heard the story. It is said that your parachute is a latex condom hooked to a dread.
Oh, hey, you're still around? It's me, Jack. I'm ripping off Ferris Bueller. Today's episode was brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com, whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design. No matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to lynda.com/cracked today. That's lynda.com/cracked for a 10-day free trial. Thanks, Lynda, and thanks for listening, guys.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. Oh, oh, oh. The wolf dead.